Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to today's lunch. We're going to go ahead and get started with our speaker, but please feel free to continue enjoying your meal. Our speaker for today, as you all know, because you read his bio and what he was talking on and chose to come, but it is John Purcell, and he of course, is with Monsanto, based out of Hawaii, and I'm going to let him go ahead and fill in some of the more details as he tells his story today. So please join me in welcoming John.
Thanks, Holly. Appreciate it. I want to start with thanking Holly and the organizers for giving me this opportunity. I'll tell you a little bit myself. So I've been in agriculture for 30 years now, although my communications team changed my bio to say 3 decades, which I said, okay, you know you're officially old when they change years to decades, but that's I think it's been a wonderful journey. And I think as a biologist, to see how modern biology has really transformed what we're trying to do in so many sectors of agriculture. I've been in a number of different roles, worked in a number of different crops, corn, cotton, wheat, but for the last 8-9 years been in pretty much in the veg business, as well as the Hawaii organization here reports into me, and I had the pleasure of spending about 2.5 years in Hawaii. And what I want to do today is kind of hopefully give you a sense of how things transpired in Hawaii, some of the historical pieces, as well as some of the challenges that every grower faced in Hawaii because of the attacks on agriculture. But I also want to then really turn it to about the broader conversations about food, about agriculture. It's such an important conversation. We need to make sure that we're engaged and make sure we're doing things. I want to start with just kind of setting the stage for this around a day in the life, if you will, of somebody who works for a seed company in Hawaii. So imagine your typical day when you wake up. You get up, go to work, kind of log into your computer probably, maybe go out to the field, check out your plots, etc. But imagine you wake up, you turn on your computer, you check your Facebook, your Instagram, whatever media you're using, and you see a series of personal attacks, not just against you, but against your family, saying you're poisoning these islands, get off the islands, etc. You then wake the kids up to take them to school. You're walking to school, and on that route, there's wanted posters with your face on it. It says, wanted for the destruction of Hawaii. And you're looking, and your kid's looking at you, Daddy, what's that about? Right? Can you imagine? I mean, this is what it's like. You drive to work, you turn on the radio, and there's attack ads talking about what these companies are doing, what farmers are doing to Hawaii. You then get to work, and there's protesters blocking your site. You can't get on the farm. And the police are there clearing them so you can drive your truck onto the farm. I wish I was describing a hypothetical situation, but this was reality. This is how bad it got until a few years ago here on the islands. I mean, this is what our employees and employees of all the seed companies of Hawaii faced virtually every day. And you think about people who are dedicating their life to ag, dedicating their lives to growing food, to helping farmers be productive. And this is what you faced every day. Welcome to my world. Welcome to our world. Luckily, it's improved. And I'm going to talk about some of the things we did, but let me walk you through some of the history that got us to that point. The seed companies have been in Hawaii for over 50 years. There was a very influential man, Dr. James Brubaker, Dr. B, amazing geneticist, corn geneticist. He's really the father of corn seed in Hawaii. Because what he recognized is you had some amazing assets here in Hawaii. And you don't think of corn necessarily in the Hawaii context. You think of other crops. But he recognized you got an amazing climate. You have a great agricultural history. You have an agricultural workforce that were extremely comfortable working long days in the field, doing great science, really to help and drive that. And so he really attracted some of the early seed companies to say, you all should think about, even though your corn's going to end up in Argentina or Brazil or in the Midwest of the U.S., the Midwest of the mainland, you should think about Hawaii as a research facility. Think about what the advantages are. And huge advantages, obviously, think about climate, from climatological. You can grow Hawaii here year-round. You can turn 3 cycles of corn. Think about that from a breeder's perspective, to be able to multiply your seed from your early manufacturing piece, to actually increase your volumes, three turns on corn is an awesome thing to have. So there was a lot of dynamics at play that said this would be a great thing. For many years, it was a growing industry, and the good thing about that growth was it was in parallel with the decline of other agricultural sectors within Hawaii. Used to be, people thought about Hawaii, you thought about sugarcane, you thought about pineapple. You think the last sugarcane plantation in Hawaii just closed, HCNS on Maui. 38,000 acres. Phew, gone. That was the last plantation in Hawaii. Why? Think about land costs. Think about labor costs. Think about water. Think about all the things you have to do to grow a crop like that. And you're competing with Brazil. You're competing with Central America. You're competing in a global scale on a commodity crop. And this is where seed made sense, because all the assets that Hawaii brings, you weren't trying to ship a whole lot of commodity crop. You were producing a very high value crop, i.e. seed, that had low shipping costs. And that's where Hawaii, in fact, in Hawaii, the largest agricultural sector in the state of Hawaii is seed production. Seed production. And you add up the next five sectors, they almost equal seed production. That's how valuable the seed industry is to Hawaii. The problem became 5, 6, 8 years ago when folks realized that, you know what, we're having some success in blocking GMOs, blocking some of the modern techniques that are out there on the mainland. I'm talking about some pretty well-funded groups, so I'll talk about it in a minute. But if we can't stop them everywhere in the U.S., across the Midwest and other places, if we stop it in Hawaii, if the seed companies can't produce their seed, you'll never get the products around the world. You'll never be able to produce seed in another place to allow GMOs or other technology to actually advance around the world. So it was a pretty smart strategy, and these are smart folks. It has started with some local groups. You will not know these, but there's groups like Shaka on Maui, Hapa on Kauai, that organized around the seed companies. A basic message: seed companies are poisoning the islands, this wonderful island we have. The irony was, it wasn't people who actually grew up in Hawaii. I'm living in California. It was a lot of Californians. a lot of Oregonians, a lot of folks that had moved to Hawaii with a certain vision of what paradise should be. And frankly, agriculture didn't really fit unless it was a small, local, biodynamic, organic or something, right? It had to be a certain niche or else they didn't want it. And yet, for the folks who lived in agriculture, who worked every day, many of our employees, we have 600 and some employees in the state, many of them, their parents, their grandparents worked on those same farms. They were working on the sugarcane. They were working on the pineapple plantation. There was a long history, and they saw seed as a great way to stay active in agriculture, be an agriculturalist, but then contribute to the economy within Hawaii. So you had the local groups, but then you also had some big names and some big power. You had groups like Center for Food Safety. If you're not familiar with the Center for Food Safety, it doesn't have a whole lot to do with food or safety. I mean, it is a very well-funded. Their address in Washington, D.C., my hometown, is Pennsylvania Avenue. They're 6 blocks from the Supreme Court and just a few more blocks from our president. This is not a, you know, grassroots kind of, you know, small-town kind of local thing. These are high-powered. You look at their staff. How many of them are lawyers? How many of them are legal support? These people are good. Earth Justice, another one. You ever walk through LAX? Never notice those posters? Earth Justice. You're not advertising LAX. You don't have an office on Pennsylvania Avenue unless you got a pretty thick wallet. These people are well-funded. They're well-organized. And they are very good at what they do. They have legal teams. They have public affairs teams. Literally, they're part of a multi-hundred-million-dollar, billion-dollar industry about how do we promote certain visions for what agriculture will be and how do we create fear. I think it was Dan or somebody over there, Larry, said, fear is a lot easier to sell than a product. For those of us in the industry, we got to bring a seed to market that somebody wants to buy. Or we got to bring an agrochemical. We got to bring a new technology that somebody wants to buy. Selling fear is pretty easy. In many cases, the advertising, you don't even need advertising. I remember, I think it was the lead of Moms Across America, who's got like 1 million followers, right? And she says, oh, I don't never believe a scientist or doctors, but when my friends put things on Facebook, I know damn well that's the truth, because the people have spoken. This is real stuff. She's on film saying this, right? But there is that mentality in there. And they are very good at social media. They will leverage their legal support. They'll leverage the social media. They will get the message out, and they will scare the heck out of people. They're very good at what they do. So what happened then in Hawaii was it actually led to a number of county initiatives. The way Hawaii is organized, you have counties, and the counties are pretty much aligned with the islands. Oahu is not only an island, it's a county. Maui is an island, but it's also the county of Maui, which is actually Maui, Molokai, and Lanai. Kauai is a county and an island. The Big Island is a county and an island. What they realized was we may not be able to do anything at the state level or at the federal level, but we can use the county because all politics are local, right? It doesn't take much to turn certain people who want to get very active in county politics may not be high on the screen of a lot of people. So let's use those county political machines and political mechanisms to actually do something to drive these people, to drive the seed companies off the islands. In some cases, they went directly to the county council. They had very favorable people who, again, would get these reports, read about, poisonings, blah, 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 and actually institute bans. In our case, we have operations on Monsanto's operations on Maui, Molokai, and Oahu. Maui and Molokai are part of Maui County. It was actually a ballot initiative, a public ballot initiative. But in all cases, Kauai, Big Island, and Maui, it was really about banning GMOs. It was explicit to say, this is not going to be allowed on these islands. Now, it's interesting, it played out a little differently depending upon where you are. Here on the Big Island, you may know the story of virus-resistant papaya. Amazing success story. Dennis Gonzalez, an amazing man, helped drive that. I mean, it saved the papaya industry. If you did not have virus resistance, you would not be growing papaya, frankly, in many, many places in Hawaii. So a virus-resistant GMO papaya was developed many years ago. They got the regulatory approvals, commercialized, and it saved the industry. So on the Big Island, they had a problem. We can't ban GMOs because we can't affect the papaya growers. So they grandfathered papaya. We don't mean papaya. We mean everything else. It's really translated, we mean corn. We need soy. We need anything that's not papaya, right? And it was a smart strategy. Politically, smart strategy. You're not going to run into problems because of the papaya growers, you're eliminated. Maui, they didn't care. It was an outright ban. And the provisions of that ban were actually pretty draconian. If you had one papaya tree, which many Hawaiians have in their backyards, a papaya tree to have, it's like us growing tomatoes, peppers, and those. They have a papaya tree in their backyard. If you had one papaya tree that was GMO in your backyard, you could be subject to a year in prison. Year in prison and $10,000 fine, escalating fine, depending upon how many trees and how many years you grew that. So think about that. A tree you've had in your backyard for 10 years, 20 years, it's where you get your papayas. Somebody's going to come out and inspect that and say, what's the GMO? Let's head to court, right? But as much as you look at it, you look at it and go, that is absurd. That's ridiculous. But they ran an amazing campaign. And I will say, we were early polling. This was 2014. We were 20 points down in the polls to start. 20 points. And we looked at this and go, holy mackerel, we got a problem. So Dow also has operations on Molokai. We got to go with them. We also got together with growers because we realized we're not the most sympathetic group for the public. It's Monsanto and Dow, even though for a lot of people it did resonate because it's jobs, it's keeping the ground actually in agriculture. It would be able to way to avoid development, which a lot of people wanted because it's actually productive acres, et cetera. But we had to get growers. And so we went out and talked to growers. And for growers, some were GMO growers, papaya and others. Some were actually grew GMO, GMO corn, so they were on board. But also other growers responded because what they saw was this was a threat not just to if you wanted to grow GMO, but what's going to be next. And I could tell you what's next, and we'll talk about it in a few minutes. It was pesticides. But it was like, if we start having these local grassroots things affecting how we grow our crop, and we all know the challenges growers face. My brother's got a ranch in Montana. I'm a part owner. He does all the 12-hour days and all the hard work, and he's the majority owner. But when I think every day what he faces, every day, the different challenge. And that's true in Hawaii. It's true everywhere. The challenges grower face. And to take away tools, that's where a lot of the growers stood up and said, wait a minute, this isn't right. So we really had to engage folks, and we knew that we could close the gap. What we didn't know was, could we actually pull it off? So we closed the gap, and our employees were amazing. And they were doing things. And these are Aggies, right? I mean, I went to an ag school. Everybody went through some kind of ag training. We're out doing door-to-door canvassing. We're doing phone banks. We're doing, in Hawaii, sign waving is a big thing. You stand on the streets and wave signs for you. Vote no on the GMO ban. I mean, who would think, you literally work 8-hour, 10-hour day on the farm and then go out to the local shopping center, hand out information, have flags. So it was a different world. The people were saying, oh my gosh, I never thought this would be in my job description, right? But when you're faced with literally your livelihoods going to be taken away unless we do so. And the response, the other response we got from the support in the community was incredible. And what we found was all the people who rely on agriculture. You know, think about Molokai. Molokai has about 14% unemployment. It is not typical Hawaii. Maui, I think, is 2.5%. I mean, it's virtually zero, right? Same with Oahu. Molokai is an agricultural community. Some of the big ranches there have shut down. Monsanto and Dow were the two largest employers on Molokai. We still are. Private employers. To the people of Molokai, this was important. This was their only hope. So they did everything to try to win support in the community. But there are other folks in the community. Things you may not think about, but some are obvious. The co-op, who's selling ingredients. Well, the reason they can sell at the price they sell to a lot of the farmers on the islands is because the seed companies are bringing in the volumes. You're bringing in pallets instead of boxes, right? It's going to lower costs for everybody. And they realized over half their business in some cases was because of the seed companies. So they were easy ones to say, we're going to help in this thing. Shipping companies, how much trucking goes around, how much stuff comes to these farms every day. Local stores near the farms. It's the agricultural people walking in there buying soda at the end of the day, or maybe something a little stronger, but you know, something to make sure that you have an economy within ag that's real, and it's a network within ag. So that part of the world, we did great, and they knew they'd be affected by the ban. So we battled, when we were working with a good polling company, we knew this was going to be a point one way or the other, one percentage point in this when this election came down. Our election night was surreal. We had all the employees in the cafeteria. We had giant screens with the election results coming in. And rather than waiting to see who our next president, who our next senator is, you're waiting to see, do I have a job? Am I going to be in business the next day? So we're sitting there, the early returns, and we knew we had worked hard with our community to get people out. In Hawaii, you could do early voting. We knew the early returns would look great. And Hawaii has a system they announce, I think it's four times, announced the results. It's not a running tally. It's four distinct times where they announced, here's the boom, 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 leading up to the final result. So we knew the early results would be good, and we were up a few points. And everybody, I said, calm down. This is a long night. This is good. We knew. I said, this is going to be razor thin. This is going to be absolutely razor thin. And then we get to the last release, and the number goes up, and I see us at 49 and the ban at 51. The hush, the gasps, the tears. Think about that. You have families there, moms, dads, working on their kids, watching this, and immediately thought, "Is my God, are we going to eat? What are we going to do?" And I'll never forget, because I said, "What the hell do you say, right?" I mean, everybody's looking at you. What, you know, right? What do you say? And I just said, "This is not over." I said, "This is not over. We are going to fight this. This is not right. It's not legal. We are not going to allow this to happen to our employees, to our community, to all the farmers in Hawaii." Fortunately, it wasn't over, because we knew legally we had strong position. You know, for a county to say something that's been approved at the EPA, the USDA, county, the statewide has all said this is okay for farmers to use, and for a county to step in and say, no, you can't do it here. You're impinging livelihood. You are actually restricting a farmer's right to execute in his or her business to actually grow the crop in the production system they want. So we knew we had a strong legal standing. I'll fast forward to the legal piece. So there were a number of appeals. The cool part was the Maui County, even with the election result came out, as soon as we filed our appeal of the election result, Maui County said, we're stepping back, we're not going to defend this thing. Because they knew they didn't have inspectors. It was all done at the state level. They didn't have any way to administer this. Did they want to throw their citizens in jail for a year for having a papaya tree in their backyard? It was a political, oh my gosh. And so they stepped back, which was great. But the local activist groups, the legal teams there, were allowed to have standing. They were allowed to take this to federal court, to defend it in federal court. Well, long story short, we went to federal district court in Hawaii. Won overwhelmingly, both at the county, state, and federal level. Then got appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court. You may not know the Ninth Circuit. It's a very liberal court. You're like, sorry, you must know California. You know, okay. It's not necessarily the most ag-friendly. They're very good judges. I'm not saying they're not reputable, but it's not necessarily the most friendly court. You're laughing. You must have history here, but it's not necessarily the friendliest court for agriculture. But again, three-person panel, it was unanimous. And this was about a year after the initial result that said this is, it clearly the federal has regulation over GMOs. There's a deregulation process. And some of it was on the regulated product that we were still growing, which are all done under USDA permits, right? So clearly there was federal oversight, and then the state level had oversight on products, et cetera. So legally we knew we won. And in fact, about a year later, that played out. So legally, though, it's one thing to win in court. It's another thing to win in the court of public opinion. And we realized we had a lot of work to do to build trust. And trust is a strong word. I mean, I like it when my wife says, I trust you. We've been together 40 years, and I'm like, trust is not actually a word you throw around lightly, right? Trust is a big, big thing. So we knew we had to do things to build trust. We knew, though, historically, the seed companies had been really good citizens, both for how we conduct our operations on the farm, but also ag giving back, we call it here in Hawaii, hashtag ag giving back, where all the community events, all the volunteer events, all the scholarships, all the things. We knew we had a lot of that going, but in both cases, we were doing a really lousy job of talking about it. And part of it is you don't want to pat yourself on the back, right? You don't want to say, oh, look at all this great stuff we're doing. But we knew we had to take a different tack, both in our operational pieces, as well as talking about what we do in the community. The other piece we had as far as an asset go, besides just the basics of what we did on the farms and what we did in the community, was we had a lot of data. And one of the things we saw from the election was we had a lot of demographic data. Certain groups, millennials, we got crushed. We got absolutely crushed. Moms, well, actually, Caucasian moms from 29 to 44, we got crushed. We got absolutely crushed. But other communities, people who lived on Hawaii their whole life actually voted no. Maui or Molokai, 2-1 no. The entire island was 2-1 no, because it's an agricultural community. Communities that were basically people that worked for a living, I'll frame it up, overwhelmingly no. One of the political scientists at UH looked at it and said, I've never seen a map that looks like this, because he looked at every district, every voting district, literally. The towns of where we had certain below a certain economic level, all were no. All the agriculture sections, overwhelmingly no. And then the entire ring of Maui, all those beachfront communities. And when you're knocking on a door and you're in like a $5 million house, I'm going, I wonder how this is going to go. Hi, I'm from Monsanto, right? I want you to vote no for this van. You had a feeling where it was going to go, you know. And generally, a dude opens the door, ponytail and slippers on. Hey, how you doing? Oh, great. You know, we're going to have a great conversation about agriculture, right? They had a vision of what Hawaii should be like. And it wasn't necessarily because they grew up in Hawaii. It's because they moved to Hawaii that this is what paradise was going to be. But that entire, all those beach communities, overwhelmingly no. There was no district that, even though the election was 51-49, there was virtually no district or no voting precinct that was 51-49. Virtually every voting precinct was 60-40, 70-30. It was either you were supportive of agriculture, supportive of the seed companies, or you were like scared to death and we're not going to put up with it. So, but that data was helpful because then we realized, what are we going to do? How are we going to address this and how are we going to change it? Not that legally we couldn't proceed, we could. And really it boils down to a much bigger picture that we all got to ask ourselves. And a number I always throw out for folks is that you all are probably familiar with this, but you know, 40 years ago, what percentage of the U.S. population was involved, or 100 years ago, what percent of the population involved in agriculture? Anybody know what the number is? 40%. 150 years ago, it was 70%. Anybody know what it is now? Two or less. 1.5 is the last number I saw. So we got 98%+ of the people. And every part of that 98% is probably putting some on Instagram or putting some on Snapchat of pictures of food, right? And how wonderful this part of this, how you produce this food. This is what farmers need to do. And they've been on a farm in their life. But we knew that was who we had to connect with. That's where we had to find some shared values, because that was what was dictating policy. And when social media and social, what people believe becomes enacted within public policy, that's when it gets dangerous. So we had to do something. We also knew the opposition wasn't going to stop. In fact, they're just here not long ago, Pierce Brosnan's wife, she's a real expert on agriculture, I'm sure, has put out a movie. Sorry, I don't mean to be sarcastic, but I mean, I'm hopefully people understand what I'm talking about. But she put out a movie about poisoning paradise. She's had a lot of experience on Hawaii farms, right? You know, but this is playing all around Hawaii, and she's a star. You know, Moms Across America, Zoe Honeycutt comes in, she's a star. You know, these are the people. Vandana Shiva did her tour of Hawaii. Rock star, right? Coming out, talking about, oh, what these farms are doing in Hawaii. Really? Have you ever been to the farm in Hawaii? But this is what we're up against. Again, very well funded, very slick. Slick publications, slick videos, good at social media. This is what then became the battle in the court of public opinion. So what did we do? Well, we looked back and we said, let's do some polling. Let's find out what it is that people we kind of knew what it was, but just to get affirmation. What rose to the top? Things we all think about in agriculture, sustainability. People want to know, do you care? And especially in Hawaii. I mean, I grew up on the Chesapeake Bay, right? We had everybody at bumper stickers. Still see them. Save the Bay. And agriculture faced challenges in Chesapeake Bay of Maryland, in Virginia, because you had agricultural entities, but there you had huge cities, right? D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia. How do you balance it all? How do you balance it all? And in Hawaii, of course, the land is sacred. The water is sacred. This is an amazing place to live. And people take this very seriously. You know, what it is, what are you about as a person? So sustainability was the first pillar. And when we started assessing what we do, it's actually pretty cool. I mean, not just us, many of the farms. It was the way diverse tools are being used for integrated pest management. It was the way cover crops are being used. I talked about year-round production. Let me explain how it actually works, though. At any one time, only one-third of the acres are in production. What you're doing is actually rotating one-third, 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 where one-third of the time it's land prep, getting ready for your production. One-third is actually cover crops. And then the last third is actually production. So even though something's being grown year-round on any particular parcel, that land is only being used one-third of the time. Well, think what that allows you to do from an agronomic perspective. Unlike a grower, and you're also not trying to max out. If you're a tomato grower or onion grower, you got to worry about yields. When you're producing seed, you're worried much more about seed quality, much more about the genetic purity. So you're able to do things to manage those operations actually much more sustainably than a lot of the growers. So when I looked at what we're doing, how we're utilizing our farms, how we're using modern tools to do that, all the things we do, we have drip irrigation on all the farms, saving literally tens of millions of gallons of water every year. We have catchments for the soil because you can't lose your soil here because underneath it's lava, right? And you do not want to lose that soil, right? So you've got to make sure you maintain every grain of soil you got, right? So there was amazing stuff going on, but a lot of it was because, frankly, seed production gives you the opportunity to do that because of the way you actually grow the crop. So that was one pillar. The second pillar, this is where I came in, because I came in from the vegetable business for 5 or 6 years. I was there before I moved over to Hawaii. And this is where local food production. The governor has stated very publicly they want to double local food production. Anybody want to guess what percentage of the food consumed here is actually grown here? About 10%. Even though you got an amazing climate, right? You got, oh, you can probably grow anything in Hawaii. Well, yeah, you can, but I'm a bug guy, right? The bugs love it too, right? The diseases love it too. At one level, the advantages of the climate kill you because of the agronomic challenges you have because of pest and humidity and everything else. So that pledge, though, gave us a window because I knew from my days at Seminis, and I was still directly linked with the sales guy who supports Hawaii, we knew we sold a lot of seed here. And also, right, the next farm over from us was Syngenta, also a major player in vegetables. I said, how ironic is this? We're being bashed because we don't do anything for local food production. And you got two of the largest vegetable seed companies in the world in Hawaii actually with farms. It's like, nobody knows it. Literally no one knows it. So the local angle was really important. And one of the things we did was actually put in demo plots on the farms. These were actual varieties, and they're still there, being grown by Hawaiian farmers. So people can come to the farm. They can pick tomatoes, they can pick peppers, they can go after onion, cucumber, they can do all the things that you want to look at and then say, okay, this is what we're about. We're not just about corn, not just about soybean, because it's a harder connectivity. You know, when most of the corn, as we all know, gets fed to livestock, people don't connect with it. But when you're out there in a nice tomato field or peppers, and you're looking at this pretty stuff and you're eating it, it's an easier way to connect. And so we really tried to elevate that part of our business and use that in our conversations with the community. We also knew we had given years ago, we'd given a number of acres over to a group. I was on the board now. Our operations lead is on the board, called Hawaii Ag Foundation. Hawaii Ag Foundation is an amazing foundation because they bridge everything from the farm all the way out to the chefs. They run the biggest food and wine festival in Hawaii. They have every high-powered chef loves Hawaii Ag Foundation. It's about promoting local cuisine, but it's also about promoting local agriculture. So we made available a few hundred acres for them to use then to give to smallholder growers, most of them first-generation immigrants who were growing local, a lot of Asian vegetables, et cetera. They weren't things that we sold necessarily in Seminus. More of these were things that they wanted to grow for the local population or for their communities. And that was a really cool thing because then it gave us an opportunity to talk about not only are we selling to commercial growers, but we're making land available for small 10, 20-acre growers to produce local vegetables that you'll see at farmers markets and et cetera things. And that we knew was a really big asset for us. And then, so that's the second pillar, local food production. And the third one was kids and community. You know, I have kids, everybody loves kids, but science education, right? And in Hawaii especially, you have a lot of people who go to school here, there's no jobs, so they leave. You know, and so a lot of graduates from the University of Hawaii, they'll leave. Or they'll leave after high school to go to college in California or in Oregon or somewhere on the West Coast and get back to Hawaii easily, but the jobs aren't here from a technical perspective. So what can we do with STEM education? So we actually work closely with groups like the Girl Scouts, work closely with the actual Department of Education for the state, work with local schools to bring kids into the farm. We had thousands of kids. We have had thousands of kids come to the farm and do science projects. In fact, Monday night I was at the farm because we opened up a dedicated now STEM education center that can bring groups of 25 to 50 kids in where they can actually do sessions on our farm. And they can go out to the plots, pick those tomatoes, learn about how the agronomics, then go in there and do DNA isolation or do, you know, simple experiments on growing a crop, et cetera. These are the kinds of things that we knew would resonate with people. And then the other piece of the community was we realized we had to do a better job talking about it. Hawaii did, our employees did 8,000 volunteer hours last year. That's a lot of time in the community. And it's not just in the things you think about, you know, things in agriculture or things in science. It was the homeless shelter. It was the food bank. It was a lot of community hours that our employees were dedicated to. And we turned to the folks that we were working with and said, we hate to ask this because we never asked for anything back. We said, can you help us? Can you talk to the community about what we do? And so that was sort of the three pillars. It was about, you know, it was really about the sustainability on our operations. It was about what are we doing to help local food production, and it was about what are we doing to help from an educational, especially in, you know, for a company like Monsanto and the other ag companies, STEM was a natural place to fall, right? Science, technology, right? This is all what we're about. So that was sort of the pillars that we said let's go forward. The other piece though that had to come with it's great to do all these things and it was wonderful, but if nobody knows about it. Nobody knows about it. that's the challenge, right? So we figured out how are we going to tell our story. And as one of my communications lead who we hired, she said, you know, the problem is I've been watching you guys. Nobody knows you do it. Pull back the curtain. And she actually came from TV News. And she said, you got to position it at like a fourth grade level, which she's right. TV News, you want to have an understandable message, but you got to be open. And she had friends who were farmers, which is why she left media to come to work for us. Because I want to tell agriculture's story in Hawaii. She's been wonderful, but she said, you got to do better. And then we hired a social media person. This guy was in TV News for 20 years. He ran the social media platform for Hawaii News Now. And everybody in Hawaii has the same app on their phone because it's the news, weather, traffic from Hawaii News Now. This is the guy that did it. And he said, if there's anybody who knows how to connect with people, if you can make traffic interesting, then this is the guy we want, right? So we hired him. So we had a media expert and a social media expert, and it didn't hurt. Monica was an on-air personality. People knew her from television, our communications lead. People would ask her, what the heck are you doing in Monsanto? But we recognized we're a bunch of ag people. How the heck do we know how to communicate with the world? We had to be a part of it because we had to be the people doing it, but we needed pros to help us through it. So we actually launched a very active Instagram system that really puts out photos of the farm. We do videos from the farm. And these things are amazing. I'm always shocked. We did one a few weeks ago, actually, from our Woodland farm that we put on the Hawaii Facebook page because they were visiting Monsanto, Hawaii, on the road. We had 112,000 views. Not posts, views. 112,000 of me and a couple of breeders wandering around talking about veggies. First of all, you ask the question, how bored are people that this is something they're clear? But secondly, you say, that's actually really cool. Yeah, that's actually really cool. Somebody is sitting there and they're watching it. This isn't just landing on their page. They're actually clicking it and watching it. But that gives me some hope. But we realized what made that happen was Rich knew how to connect with people. He knew how to get it into Facebook, how to post this, how to do it. And then Monica, a TV reporter, she knew how to make it interesting. I mean, the breeders are like, I can't believe she just asked me that. You know, but she makes it fun. She makes it lively. And it brings it a human element to it. And that's what the prose helped us do, is try to bring that human element to it. But it's really fun and it's really cool. And I'm a shameless plug for me. So JPP Mon Veggies, if anybody's on Instagram, that's my Instagram tag. But I put pictures of the farm every day or every other day, or things that are happening in the community out there. And we leveraged it on Monsanto Y, leveraged it on Monsanto Company, et cetera. But we had to do that. You know, we had to say, what are we going to do? So the media, social media, that's all great, but we had to also make it real for people who visited. Last year we had almost 20,000 what we call touch points. So this is 20,000 people within Hawaii that someone from Monsanto Hawaii organization talked to. Population of Hawaii is only 1.3, 1.4 million. So that means about 1 in 60, 1 in 65 people in the state actually talked to one of our employees. That's a number I'm really, really proud of. And that's really, really cool to think about that numbers of people that you're able to connect. Now, in Hawaii, you have an advantage. It is a small community, good or bad. Everybody knows everybody. Don't insult somebody. They're probably a cousin of somebody else. So just don't go there, right? It's just, you got to be really conscious of that. But the good news is news, they call it the coconut wireless. News travels fast, right? Something comes up, they're going to know on every island. Everybody's going to know. But when you're able to make that many connection points. And so how do we do it? One is, we actually, on our website, you can go on and sign up for a farm tour. We have open houses. You can come out, sign up for an open house, come out to it. We did one Monday night, 130 people there. We opened up the STEM Center. We had the ribbon cutting. We also had five charities there. We had the local homeless shelter. We had the Girl Scouts. We had United Way, all the groups that we work with. And they had demonstration booths there talking about how we work together in the community for them. So it wasn't just about us. It was about what is the community of Hawaii like. But these kinds of opportunities were great. And it was really cool for me as we started doing those, how many people would come up and say, you know, I wasn't going to come. I thought Monsanto, my friends will kill me if they heard I went to the farm. But I'm so glad I did. And when you have those moments, it's really, really cool. And you realize if we can just get people there, if we can just talk to them, if we can just connect with them. So what do we do when we're there? We actually go out to the plots. We show them our cover crops. We show them our drip irrigation. We actually show them how we apply pesticides, the dirty word of everything, right? Show them the precision applicator. Show them what we explain to them, why you need tools. Why? What are the challenges farmers face and how are we trying to address it? But how do we do it in the context of sustainability? How do we do it in a way that resonates with people? And the great thing is, probably 75%+ of our employees actually were born and raised in Hawaii. So who better to talk about the water, the land, what they truly believe in their hearts, of why they do what they do in their jobs? They are the most awesome messengers of what we're trying to do on the farm. So that's what we did. We pulled back the curtains. We brought people in. We have tours that show the sustainability practices. We show them our veggie plots. We let them pick fruit and take it home. We let them explore. We show them science experiments. Let the kids do science experiments. Simple things, you know. Just, we have a demo thing where we have soil, little tiny soil boxes. You pour water through it, and if you have a cover crop on there or you have no crop on there, you look at the water that comes out in the bottom. You know what it looks like, right? The one with no crop, it looks pretty dirty. The others, wow, the water looks clean. Well, yeah, that's why you. That's called, you know, that's how you manage your water. That's how you do use of cover crops for soil conservation, et cetera. So the good news is we said, we're going to open it up. We're going to do, but we also started getting questions. Oh, you're showing me that. How much pesticide do you use? How much, why do you use pesticides? So then this was some of the most interesting conversations I had. I actually went back to legal. I talked to more lawyers in that time period than any time in my history. Monsanto, you talked to a lot of lawyers, I can tell you. That history of my career, because what I told them, we have to publish pesticides we use. Because what had happened in the community, the activist community, there was a migration, and it's really happened. I see this globally. GMOs have kind of lost their luster in some circles because people kind of used to it. 20 years, billions of acres. But then they realized, yeah, but the pesticides scare people. And so the logic stream became GMOs make you use more pesticides. Everybody knows pesticides are bad, so let's ban GMOs. Good strategy, right? Politically, you laugh, but it's a good strategy. It makes sense. So I probably 90% of the questions I answer these days are about pesticides, not about GMOs. We're not a huge pesticide company, I mean, besides Roundup, but I mean, we're much more about seeds and traits, but all the questions they say I'm really answering now are much more about pesticides than that. So we had to be much more upfront about pesticides. So I actually got approval to actually publish. Here's all the restricted use pesticides we used. on our website. You can go on there and see how much, you know, what is the actual product we use. The interesting part of that was a lot of growers looked at it and saw, because they knew we were 8,500 acres. We were a big player. And when we put our numbers out there, and the state publishes every year how much is totally being used out there, and they saw our number, and a lot of the farmers were like, you can't put that out there, because they're going to ask me, why aren't I that low when they do the calculation of how many acres I have? And it kind of be an ironic situation. We're trying to convince farmers it's a good thing to do. And I get it, because we're not trying to get 90, you know, we're not trying to get a yield. We're not trying to get, our livelihood isn't depending upon how much pounds we're pulling off or tons we're pulling off of a field. Our livelihood depends on genetic purity, depends on, we were in a different situation. So we had to kind of work that through. So what we came up with was, let's talk about it, let's publish it, but we're going to do it in the context of IPM. We're going to talk about, here's how farmers think about pests. Here's how farmers think about the about diseases. Here's how they think about controlling pests and diseases. Let's talk about biologicals. Let's talk about cover crops to attract beneficials. Let's talk about systems like sticky traps and other things we're using, monitoring, the basics of how you think about pests and disease. And then we'll talk about pesticides. And for people, it makes it, okay, I get that, because you're starting with a foundation of, we want to do a good thing. We want to work with biologists. We want to do a sustainable approach. And as it turns out, we use about less than 0.5% of all the restricted-use pesticides in the state. And that was a great message to say, look, we're doing a lot. But the other cool thing we did was we got numbers through from the state on who actually is using pesticides. And what the farmers liked was, it came out, agriculture was using less than a third of all the restricted-use pesticides in the state. Hawaii, you want to guess who's using them the most? Structural. Termites? You ain't treating, you ain't got a house. If I learned that when I moved here, because I went to hang up a picture, and dink, I said, I must have hit a stud. And I said, that's the hardest stud I ever hit. And I said, they're steel. I said, what? And I said, because they don't use wood on your two-by. My dad was a carpenter. You don't use two-by studs. You use metal, because you won't have a house. So termites are huge. So it turned out, actually, urban structural use was using the most pesticides in the state. And then the state and county was using the second most, and farmers, ag was third. And so now the farmers love this. Great. Because, you know, you're worried about what I'm spraying on my farm. What about schools? What about everything else? And then the state also released, there were 11, I think, evacuations of schools because of quote unquote pesticide use. Zero were due to farmers. So the state actually issued the report saying, look, folks, we got to have a more mature conversation about this. Because the narrative that was out there was, farmers are you spraying all this stuff, schools are being evacuated and all this. You know, it was literally, some cases, it was the custodian at the school itself or a homeowner next door that got away. It wasn't the pros. It wasn't the people that are using them every day. And so that was the kind of messaging to get a different kind of conversation, even on a topic as emotive as pesticides. Changing the tenor, bridging it in the context of, actually, pesticides are really valuable. You want a house? You're probably using a pesticide. Infestion. Urban structural use, et cetera. So that's what we tried to do, is try to build that conversation. And then, so that was the sustainability part. When people come out to the farm, the veggie plots are showcased. You know, they go out, they pick tomatoes, they pick peppers, they do all those things to really help. Especially for the legislators, for the decision makers, for them to come out and say, oh, wow, these guys are part of local food production. They're part of what we're trying to build here to increase our local. And the other thing we did, which was really cool, we had an event here almost a year ago now. It was an education event for vegetable growers. Had almost 100 growers sign up, which was awesome. We partnered with Hawaii Ag Foundation. We partnered with Hawaii Farm Bureau. Partnered with the State Department of Agriculture, USDA, University of Hawaii. And then all the way down the line, after these six or seven, was Seminus, our seed-branded vegetables. Because what we wanted to do was talk about, really, really, what would it take to double local food production? How do we make our growers, our farmers, successful? And we didn't stop with the agronomic piece. We had a lot of sessions on agronomics, and we actually had all the suppliers. They brought equipment out. They brought out, you know, different chemistries or biologicals. We had all that. We had the plots. We had UH set up screen houses to show how you can reduce your press pressure. I mean, a lot of agronomics were in it. But we also had the biggest food or vegetable and produce suppliers for the grocery stores. Talk to them about, here's what it takes to get in our supply chain. Here's the quality you need to meet. And probably the biggest coup we had was, we had four chefs. And I could tell you, in Hawaii, chefs are rock stars. I mean, these are well-known. Everybody, and we had one of the biggest names come out, and he said, I'd love to participate. And we had a chef's panel at lunch, and the growers loved it. Because to have these people that they're, like I say, they're rock stars, talking to them about, here's what it would take to get vegetables into my restaurant. That was really, really powerful kind of stuff. So it was awesome. And I think we even made the front page news on the Star Advertiser business section. A local seed company gives back to the community by organizing an event. We're like, cool. We were hoping that Hawaii Farm Bureau, other people would get credit, but we're happy with that. And they came out, filmed stuff, they did the whole thing. And then, of course, use all your social media channels. But that was a way to kind of really take advantage of the local side and to think about that, think about those partners in the community. Who is it has a vested interest in doing this? And a lot of it is just finding shared values. You know, whether it be sustainability, whether it be local food, find a shared value that you can communicate with and work with on them and go there. And then the final piece is kids and education. And we've had some wonderful, wonderful partners. The Girl Scouts do an amazing job with STEM. I mean, because what they're saying is we have got to not have so many young ladies drop out of science middle school. You know, it's like they get to be 11 and 12. All of a sudden, it's not cool. We're not going to be the science nerds. I hate to say it. There's still that kind of societal pressure. So they're really, really working to get kids through that bridge. Because once they get to high school, actually, it's fine again. They don't worry about it so much. So they're really trying to drive that. So we had a lot of great partners. And as I said, I mentioned tonight, we opened up a STEM center on site. But the education community has been wonderful. Because the good news about when you work with educators is they're looking for all the help they can get. Because budgets are so tight, they want to have any assets they can have. And then, of course, all the tools we had, and bringing in the professional help, really bringing in the communicators from TV and other communications avenues to help us tell the story. So what is the current state? And I think the current state, the other side doesn't stop. I mean, a lot of it has shifted more toward a state level, trying to get state legislation that would then basically void what the federal courts have already ruled. And as I said, these people are very well funded. They're not going away. They're not going away, so that continues. But the good news is we got a very engaged workforce. When you've been through this kind of roller coaster, as I say, when you're sitting there watching election returns, worried about, am I going to have a paycheck in 2 weeks? That's an incredibly bonding experience, right? I mean, you get through something that a lot of people never did in their lives, right? Especially when your kids are sitting next to you. So the workforce has been amazing, and they're all posting on Instagram. They're all wanting to do it. Everybody wants to help. Everybody wants to do something. So that's a really cool piece. The many allies in the community, that's been wonderful to see. And people recognizing, you know, maybe I should think about this a little more reasonably. I did an event yesterday, radio, Hawaii Public Radio. And I was really, really pleased because we kind of went through the initial stuff about reputation and all the things that people say about it. But then the last 90% of the talk was about challenges to agriculture. What's stopping us locally? What are the global challenges? Climate change, all these kinds of things that we want to talk about. That's the real conversation about food. And it was wonderful to go through HPR yesterday and do that session and say, wow, it wasn't about the crap you usually have to talk about. It was actually a real conversation. But how great is that, right? But that's the tenor is changing. The tone is changing. You know, the challenges continue, but the tenor is changing in Hawaii, certainly. But I do want to finish with sort of the bigger picture. Because I think for all of you, when I encourage you to think you're not, first of all, I wanted you to think about whether or not this could ever happen in your community. I'm telling you, we're seeing this pop up in so many places. You are not immune. Even if you're in a state that heavily relies on agriculture, like California. When I do events in San Francisco, you would never know they're 30 miles from the biggest farms in the world, right? Their vision of what farming is, what agriculture is so far removed from reality. Even though they're in, well, biased, of course, but California is the leading state in agriculture, right? At least vegetables and other crops, right? As I said earlier, everybody's talking about food. Everybody's posted a picture of it, but the reality of what it really takes to put that food on the table just isn't there. So I think one of the biggest challenges we have is society has become very binary in their thinking. I think about the ranch in Montana my brother has, and he does an amazing job. In fact, he was just honored by the governor of Montana for his sustainability and his efforts on the ranch. But people come to the ranch. It's only about 200 acres, which is small by Montana standards. But they come and they say, oh, this is wonderful. But in their minds, what are they doing? They're checking the boxes. It's small. It's local. We do local pork, full circle local pork. It's small. It's local. It's family owned. This is what agriculture needs to be. And it is. It's wonderful. But we ain't putting pork chops in grocery stores around the country, right? We ain't trying to keep food at the low level that Americans are used to paying, about 10% versus much lower than the rest of the world. We got to have room for all of agriculture. You know, because the fact is, some of the largest growers can be absolutely some of the most sustainable growers that are out there. But people equate small, local, organic, put your whatever descriptor in there, equals sustainable, equals what I want. It's black and white. It's good and bad. It's right and wrong. That isn't reality. And it's a dangerous situation we're driving to in the developed world. Developing world has all different challenges. But in the developed world where we're so binary and this is what we got to have all of agriculture be, that's not sustainable, folks. And I always tell the story of one of our growers in the UK, actually. Again, the Western Europe is very similar to U.S. to how the food conversation is going. So they're a huge brassica leafy grower. They do double cropping. What I mean by that is they'll go into a field and they'll get all their broccoli or lettuce, et cetera. But if you've ever been to a broccoli or lettuce field after they harvest, there's a whole lot of green left. And the last time you walk through, did they harvest it? Because the specks are so tight. They know exactly what size, what shape, what color. There's a lot of green material left there. So they come back and they harvest all the rest. Why do they do that? They take all the biomass on their plant. I mean, on their farm, they have anaerobic digestion plants. What is an anaerobic digestion plant? It produces electricity. They take all that biomass. The electricity that they produce powers their entire operation. They actually sell electricity back to the grid. And the lovely part is they got the grant from the government to do it, and they sell the electricity back to the government. I mean, that's how good a situation is that for a farmer, right? So it's awesome. But then the CO2 that's produced as a byproduct goes out to their greenhouses. The water is all recirculated. The sludge at the end of the digestion goes back in the field as fertilizer. And these guys are huge, tens of thousands of acres. They supply every major retail in the UK. Is there any definition of sustainability that operation wouldn't meet? But is it small? Is it local? Does it have any? No. But they're thinking about what is the impact we want to have. They're thinking about it beyond just the value of that broccoli they're harvesting. They're thinking about water, energy, CO2. They're thinking about the whole equation. And it's the scale that allows them to do it. If they didn't have the thousands of acres, they're not keeping that digestion plant going. They're not going to be able to sustain that energy generation piece because they're not going to have the biomass. I like that example because it kind of gets people out of the realm of it's got to be small, local to be sustainable. Actually, that's an incredibly sustainable operation. And here in the U.S., you think about what people are doing in many crops, the carrot and others, the sustainability measures that the major producer are doing are incredible. The attention on food waste, the attention on impacts of their operations. There are great examples of large growers around the world and in the middle of the world that are meeting those needs. So as much as I can, when I get out, and I've been lucky, I was laughing earlier at the table because I've been getting invited to more and more foodie events. And these are interesting propositions for guys who walk in farms for 30 years, right? It's like the last one, there were four in the plenary session. There was one on humanely raised livestock, which I get. Okay, that's reasonable. The second one was meatless meat, which is about how do you make something taste like meat that doesn't have any meat in it. And then the third one, my favorite just preceding me, was prancing pigs, where they play music, you know, listen, the pigs are so happy before they slaughter them, they prance to the... My brother and I do pigs, right? We give them beer every once in a while, they stumble around a little bit, and I've never seen them prance, but... And I didn't mean disrespect the previous speaker, but I shared that with the audience as well, but this is what... And this was 335 chefs in the audience, right? This is the information that they're getting. This is the view of agriculture they get, and then they get me. Talking about farms, talking about what we try to think about, what challenges farmers face. But what's great about it is how many people come up after and say, God, that's really good to hear somebody that actually sounds like they've been on a real farm. I said, well, yeah, I've been on a few, but it's good the response you're getting because I can tell you the food influencers, the bloggers, the chefs, the people that really impact how people think about farm and agriculture, many of them are in a bubble. They are in an absolute bubble. So my appeal to you all is we got to get out. We got to do more. We have bloggers and chefs. Two of them came out for our field days a couple weeks ago. They wrote great pieces on melons, on different things they saw on the farm. And their questions are not easy ones. There's some tough ones, but just invite them out. Have them talk to you about your operation. Talk about what agriculture is really about. Talk about what it really takes to put food on that table. Because we got to do a better job of popping that bubble. Because what they're hearing otherwise is pretty far removed what actually happens on farms. So I'm going to stop there. Hopefully I've stimulated a few questions. I look forward to the conversation, the discussion, et cetera. But just wanted to share with you what we've been trying to do in Hawaii, which is, I'll be honest, a pretty tough situation for viewers and still has a lot of challenges. But also try to give you a little perspective on the things I'm seeing globally as I'm out, not just on our farms, but really out in the communities that have huge influence on what happens in agriculture and how and where food comes from. So thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it. Questions, comments? Yes, please. It's actually in Hawaii, because most of our business is actually in corn, so those are not grown here. We're doing, Hawaii is our seed production unit, where we do have sales in the vegetable sector. So that, when we think about what products people use, Monsanto products, it's vegetable seed and it's Roundup. And Roundup is used in lots of agronomic systems, obviously, and then even in home use, of course, it's Roundup. So that's the only sales we have there. But there is no corn and soybean here, besides seed production. So it's not a big piece of our business, but we're actually pretty good size as far as within the vegetable sector, even though it's a small sector. Yeah. Yes, please. Your feel is pretty accurate. Because and what I tried to do, and a lot of it is I cashed in a lot of chips. I mean, I've been at Monsanto almost 30 years, and so I knew them. And I think there was a trust level built in, or she had to start with that, obviously. But what I did was I tried to frame it up as, you guys think about the risk side. What is the risk if we don't have operations in Hawaii? If we cannot produce virtually every bit of corn, every variety or every hybrid of corn comes to Hawaii at one point. I'm talking about globally. And that's pretty much true for every seed company here. If we lose the ability to use our Hawaii farms to do that, the business risk is much, much greater than the risk of actually publishing what we're doing. And then the other thing is, once I had this data from the state and they saw that actually our percentage is really small. And the other thing we did when we released the data was we put what the active ingredients were of the restricted use pesticides, and then we put a link to, oh, by the way, these same active ingredients are found in all these home products. So people go, and we actually said, go in your garage, go in your, look and see, you're probably using this at home. And that was a really good connection point with people go, oh, I didn't know you use this. Yeah, we use more, so it becomes restricted use because of the volumes, but the active ingredients, I think it was over 70% of the active ingredients we used were actually products that are found in home products. And that was a real eye-opener. So the volumes, or the actual numbers helped us. The state being so vocal about publishing all the numbers for the state, I mean, they didn't break it down by who used it, but you could see by sector and by island and all that. There was a lot of data out there already. And then I just presented as the risk of not doing it was, we're going to continue to get hammered, because if you look at Center Food Safety's report, they talk about dousing their fields. They talk about drenching of pesticides. The language they use is so emotive. The title of their publication is Poisoning Paradise. Gives you a tone. It wasn't exactly a rational view of what agriculture is about, right? This was the materials that were already out there. So to the public, they thought, my gosh, how much are these folks using? And they knew we were big. 8,500 acres in Hawaii is a lot of acres. So they just assumed, of course, came with that, all the pesticides. What helped us was the state had already publicized a lot of stuff. And then secondly, we knew, as I knew, our numbers would be good. And then framing it up in the context, two contexts. One is, how is it integrated in an integrated pest management strategy? But also, let's talk about pesticides and their value in your home, their value to protect structures, how the county and state use it. So we tried to reframe the conversation, and that got them comfortable about why we had to do it. But it wasn't an easy conversation, because risk aversion is, I think it's taught in law school. I think it's just one of the good. But that's their job, right? Their job is to make sure you as a person, if you hire a lawyer, you want them looking out for you. As a company, you want that lawyer to look out for you, right? Yes, please. Actually, quite a bit. So Sitar is wonderful, been a wonderful partner. We've been very fortunate to work with their extension group, but also their basic science group. A number of our, as you can imagine, a number of our staff are graduates of the university, many of them through Sitar. That's the College of Tropical Ag, in case you don't know, but the in human resources. But the they've been a wonderful partner, and we've been fortunate to be able to get you some corporate dollars to fund scholarships and fellowships and things to help, because they really are in a tough situation, as you know. It's making sure that the graduates see a career path in Hawaii. It's tough because there just aren't that many opportunities, and they've just been a great partner with us. And in fact, at that Vegucation event, they set up their screenhouse. In fact, they still have it on our farm. So we have tomatoes outside the screenhouse and tomatoes inside the screenhouse, and people go, wow, does he look at the same crop? And a pretty simple technique for a grower to use, not expensive, but the protection you get because you reduce your pressure. And that was all they're doing, because that's the system they're trying to drive with their extension agents. So it's both the educational piece, funding students and helping, giving them opportunities, internships and others, but also working with the extension agents directly. They've been a great partner, though. And that's what these things are about, the right partnerships in the community and in both the educational partners as well as other partners is really the key to this. So. Other questions, comments? Any challenges you all are facing in this regard? Anything resonate? You're laughing, so I know you have some stories. You did that. From an appeals back to the Supreme Court, you mean, Tim?
Yes.
Yeah. They're a tough court. But you know, like I say, when you get a unanimous, it tells you the solidity of the arguments, the legal arguments you're making. So, yeah. Any other questions, comments? Yeah, it's one of the more, I mean, I've been very, very fortunate. I've been on farmers' fields now in 36 countries, and I'm talking, you know, you think about whether it be South Africa or India or Indonesia, et cetera, it's reality, man. I mean, this is when you have an India grower talk about, oh, my God, this is wonderful BT cotton. My kids don't have backpack sprayers on anymore. I mean, this is real stuff. I had a grower in South Africa, and she told me, see this house? DeKalb Seed helped me build this house because in South Africa, many of the growers are women because of the AIDS epidemic. I mean, this is real stuff. And as a scientist, God, Rick, does it get any better, right? When you hear those kinds of stories directly from people with a couple acres max, you know. I also had the, I'll say, pleasure in quotation marks. I was the head of biotechnology for Monsanto in Europe. I had hair before then. I mean, this was, it was not an easy job. So 3 years I spent in Europe, 1999 to 2002. And that was the time of mad cow disease, the dioxin scare, and everything was attributed to GMOs. You know, we didn't have any GMOs growing there, and all of a sudden GMOs were causing every food thing that happened in the world. But what I appreciated, because our organization, Europe, also supports Africa as well, the huge influence, the NGOs of Europe, and the governments of many European countries have on Africa and development. And it's sad. I mean, frankly, they're holding back technologies that can save lives today, frankly, right? And I think it's one of the real pities. And you know, one of the problems of parliamentary governments is they need coalitions. And what happens is you might have 40% with a couple of them. You need another 5%, so you go and you enlist the Green Party to join your coalition. And what do they give the Green Party as a reward for joining the coalition? They give them the environment ministry. So now you've got a party that's only 5% of the population that actually controls a huge piece of public policy. And part of that policy is how they work with the developing world. And so it's not just the NGOs you know about that are very active in Africa. It's actually the governments of those countries, because it's left to the environmental ministry to really do a lot of the things for ex-country development. I think the encouraging piece is that is some of the partnerships that are happening. We have a program called WEMA, Water Efficient Maize for Africa, and who are our partners? The Gates Foundation, Buffett Foundation. You know, the good news about folks like Buffett and Gates, one is their wallets are really thick, and secondly is they really want to do the right thing, and they don't care about the flack, and they can get into conversations that there's no way Monsanto or Syngenta or Dow or DuPont could ever get into as far as conversations with those governments and talking about, we're here going to try to help you. They don't have the baggage that we have, frankly. So I think the encouraging piece is there's a lot of these coalitions, and many times it's with groups like CARI, the Kenyan Agricultural Research Institute, you know, really reputable scientific groups within these countries partnering with a Gates Foundation, a Buffett Foundation. But then we're happy to help. You know, we have technology, we have know-how, we have people that want to help. But we can't be the headliner in it. It's got to be those groups that are driving it. And then bringing in U.S. universities as well. In fact, I know that a lot of the university technologies think about how do they contribute to the developing world as well. But it's that, again, that public-private partnership and having the right people in the face of this that's going to encourage it. Because just like my description of what happens in Hawaii, these groups are well-funded, they have a lot of legal, and they are very well-connected from a government perspective. So it's going to take that kind of public-private partnership with the public entities within those countries, too, to really bring technologies to these. And my gosh, if there's a place that needs it, it's Africa, right, and parts of Southeast Asia. And you're in those farms, you get a lot of satisfaction, but then you realize the challenges they face every day. And this is the difference between people living and dying. You know, it's not, can I get GMO-free calamari, right? This is about real lives, right? Sorry, I saw that in New York when I was with my daughter. I'm going, really? GMO-free calamari? Like, but that, you know, that's the conversation we have in the U.S., right? And they're worried about, do I feed my kids this week, right? Am I going to have a crop at the end of the season? So we need those partnerships. Other questions, comments? Yes, please. We just had a great conversation at our table on CRISPR-Cas9, right? So gene editing. The potential is huge. And I think when I think about it for us, some of it's going to be basically just better ways to do what we already do. And I think about some of the first products will be really knockouts, you know, on point, which you used to do with mutagenesis or even just screening for populations that have a certain variant. Using gene editing, go in specifically make those. So it's just a better way to actually do those selections. Others are going to be things that are really going to revolutionize like how we do breeding. If we're able to use that to really drive some of the recombination selections we do, to eliminate the drag. So we might find a great source in back up in vegetables, very little of our portfolio, sweet corn and squash, only two GMO. The rest is all through advanced breeding, molecular breeding markers, et cetera. So any ways we can accelerate our breeding technologies, and to me, that's what's going to, gene editing could be a huge key to unlock a huge amount of value from that perspective, not just in the primary kind of knockout kind of products. I know there's a few presentations this afternoon I want to see, but also just how you think about accelerating your breeding. How do you, especially the delinking of drag? My gosh, if we can do that efficiently, Rick, how much time would that save you, right? I mean, it'd be huge, right? And so the promise is there. But I could tell you, I'm on the Science and Technology Committee, Produce Marketing, PMA, right? There's a lot of conversation. And what's cool is, it's not just in the veggie world, it's citrus, it's berries. It's a lot of people thinking about, my gosh, genome editing, CRISPR-Cas9, all the different permutations of it can have a huge impact on how we think about our breeding programs. The fear is if it becomes GMO 2.0, if it migrates to the regulatory system and it's $25, $30 million per product to get a GMO approved, it ain't going to survive. You know, it'll be the death knell for, especially in vegetables where over half our business is in Europe and Middle East. So there's no way in heck if it migrates to that. And there are forces very active trying to drive it that way. Don't be mistaken. The other side hasn't looked at this and go, okay, we got to stop this now before it even gets started. So there's a lot of forces saying, no, this is just another GMO. No, it's not. It's a better way to breed. There is no transgene in that product, right? And this is but that's the fear. So for me, the promise is huge, both some of the initial products that will come out, but also just the impact it can have on how we do breeding. But then the fear is if it migrates to GMO 2.0 from a regulatory and public perception, we're in a whole lot of trouble. And it's too promising. The other thing that's encouraging in that respect, though, is because it's accelerating so quickly on the human health, that may help because you think about there's a new public, it seems like every other week somebody's, oh my gosh, you know, whatever the single gene mutation that they're trying to now correct, and you have even patients right now where they're talking about successes of that. So that does help you because then people are looking, oh, this is a good one. This is the technology we like, right? And so hopefully if we can keep it in that vein. Yeah, and that whole thing about how people think about technology. We had a grower. She was from the Midwest. She was wonderful. She goes, why am I in an industry where people want me to grow things the way I did my grandfather did 50 years ago? She's like, my God, do you want the 50-year-old phone? You know, no, I don't think so, right? But something about food elicits a different, but she was like laughing, but she was frustrated as heck too. She goes, well, think about what my farm looks like compared to, and her granddad literally farmed those same acres. And what she does now versus what he, it's a whole different world and a much better world, but people are challenging, can you go back? So we got to keep technology and innovation at the forefront. And yesterday, that was great. We got a great discussion on Hawaii Public Radio about that, the value of innovation, the value of allowing farmers to have technologies that they can take advantage of. So keep your fingers crossed. But that's why it's important to get out, have the conversation about how valuable these technologies would be. We're all scientists, right? Or a lot of us are scientists. We're talking to people every day. It doesn't have to be big things. You don't have to go to a chef event. Heck, talk to your community group. Community organizations have things all the time. You know, things we've had, you know, Rotary clubs, for example. They have speakers all the time just to learn more about the, you know, church groups. We go into church all the time, talk about there's a gardening groups, the butterfly club. We had the butterfly club in Wild. They loved it. We gave them a bunch of monarch larvae. Oh my God, can you give us? Sure, come on out. We have a lot of them. We have crown flowers all around the farm. So you're making connections with groups you wouldn't necessarily think of, but you have actually good conversations. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be on TV or radio to do it. You're making a difference by doing that. Any other comments, questions? Well, I know you guys got a lot of choices. I appreciate you making this choice today. I appreciate the time, and Holly, appreciate the opportunity and the invitation. So enjoy the rest of the meeting. Thank you much.